dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at GatesFoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
What can your $25 do? Help build a member match fund for our fall pledge drive. Combined with contributions from your neighbors, your gift of $25, $50, or $100 or more has real impact on the vitality of WILL as a community resource. Send your check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org. If we all do a little, it can add up to a lot.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Imagine your children haven't eaten for a couple of days. There's nothing in the house, you have no money, and the charitable assistance you've received isn't enough to carry you through until you're eligible for another ration. This is the situation many found themselves in the early 1930s. The Great Depression, along with drought, proved disastrous for the country. Food riots took place across the country. There were fears that the country was headed for revolution. So when Franklin Roosevelt won the presidency in 1932, he knew he'd have to turn things around and do it quickly. The Federal Emergency Relief Act was launched in 1933. The Works Progress Administration followed. On the program today, we'll go inside the WPA's Federal Theater Project. It provided jobs for writers, actors, and other artists. It became a platform for cutting-edge theater that electrified audiences. Who were the artists involved? Well, they included Orson Welles, John Houseman, Sinclair Lewis, and Richard Wright. The Federal Theater Project also proved controversial. It would become the first victim of a Red Scare. Our guest this afternoon is Susan Quinn. She is the author of Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, your comments. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Susan Quinn is the author of four books. Her latest, Furious Improvisation, is published by Walker & Company. More about the book and its author, Susan Quinn, at the website www.furiousimprovisation.com. Susan Quinn, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be here.
What kind of assistance was available to people suffering as a result of the Depression and drought in the first couple of years of the 30s?
Well, almost nothing. And that was the huge debate in 1932 in the election between Herbert Hoover and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The view of the Republicans and conservatives up till that time was that the federal government really shouldn't be involved in helping people at all. And most people didn't have anything to do with the federal government except when they went to the post office. So the idea that the federal government would step in a major way was considered quite radical, and some thought it was socialism or communism in the making. But in 1932, the people clearly agreed with Roosevelt because he was elected by a huge majority.
So before the federal government stepped in, What kind of aid was available? What kind of assistance was available, and who provided it?
Well, primarily the Red Cross and charitable institutions, private charitable institutions, and there was some state aid, state relief, but it was very much inadequate. And people are, you know, the Red Cross argued that it could handle the problem, but it was so obvious. You mentioned food riots. People were losing their homes at a huge rate and losing their jobs at the rate of 30,000 a day, every day, for the first 3 years after the crash. So the situation was really desperate by the time Roosevelt took office.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about these food riots. How did they erupt, and how common were they?
They were pretty common in cities and towns. And I opened my book with the story of one in a place called England, Arkansas, where the sharecroppers, who were very poor anyway, finally got fed up because they didn't have food for children, and went in and confronted the head of the Red Cross and threatened to break into the local grocery store were given a small amount of money, enough to sort of tide them over so that they didn't riot. But in other places and in cities all around the country, there were people breaking into grocery stores for food.
Yeah, and early in the book you include a farmer, an Arkansas farmer, a photograph of him. It's so moving, this photo. You want to describe that for us?
It's a picture of a very gaunt and hungry-looking farmer, and he's holding a Red Cross seed packet. It's called a garden seed package, because the idea of the conservatives was that you should not give farmers money or food. You should give them the means to create food. So the Red Cross was giving away these garden seed packets, and here's a man who's clearly very hungry and desperate, holding this seed package, which of course isn't going to produce any food for a year. And that was it. Sort of in one photograph, I think, sums up the bankruptcy of this argument that you can't give direct aid to people. You'll corrupt them. That was the idea. You would corrupt and undermine their morals if you actually handed out food to people.
Yeah. Well, how serious then were concerns about revolution?
Well, they were very serious, and even the New York Times talked about class warfare as a possibility. And certainly when Roosevelt was elected and was about to take office, he went back to Hyde Park, and a friend came and spoke with him and said, if you succeed, you will be remembered as one of the greatest presidents, and if you fail, you will be remembered as one of the worst. To which Roosevelt replied, if I fail, I shall be the last president.
Mm. So he's under tremendous pressure at that point.
Yes, absolutely.
And one of the first things he got through Congress was the Federal Emergency Relief Act. What did it provide?
Well, it provided direct relief and some jobs, but they were sort of make-work jobs in the beginning. They were, you know, raking and shoveling kind of jobs. And Roosevelt was not happy with this because he did feel that the dole, as he called it, was a narcotic, and he didn't want to just hand out jobs and money and meager food to people. He wanted people to have meaningful work. And that was why the WPA was created in 1935. And it's a more sophisticated relief program. It was called the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, and that employed a huge number of people. It was probably the largest public works progress program in the history of the world. And it employed 8.5 million people. They built 650,000 miles of roads, hundreds of thousands of public buildings, bridges, parks, 800 airports. The WPA was an enormous program and really a successful program in putting people, desperate people, back to work.
Very ambitious program.
Yes, indeed.
And it required someone at the helm who was a powerhouse, and that would be Harry Hopkins. Tell us about him.
Harry Hopkins was an Iowa boy, graduated from Grinnell College. He was a social worker by training, and he started out as a social worker on the Lower East Side, dealing with poverty of immigrants coming to the New World. And then he got a job with Roosevelt when he was governor of New York, doing a similar kind of thing, a relief program in the state of New York. So when FDR was looking around for the right person to head up the WPA, he chose Harry Hopkins. Hopkins was a very sort of acerbic, frank, no-nonsense kind of guy, and he was very intolerant of any kind of corruption, which was really important because the potential for corruption and misuse of funds was, of course, enormous with this huge program. And he really pulled off the program with an amazing amount of, with a lack of corruption, which is really quite surprising. I mean, there were, of course, problems on the local levels, problems of favoritism and so on, but he fought that very hard and was a very effective leader of the WPA.
Yeah. And then another key figure in the story is a woman by the name of Hallie Flanagan.
Right, yeah. And she also came from Grinnell College. We went to Grinnell College and knew Harry Hopkins there. But she had really established her own reputation since coming out of Iowa. She had been one of the very first women to get a Guggenheim Fellowship and traveled to Europe, and she just imbibed the theater of Europe. She met everybody. She met all the famous playwrights. She met Pirandello. She met Stanislavski. She took all of that back with her to Vassar, where she became a very well-respected kind of experimental director, did a lot of cutting-edge work. And then Harry Hopkins chose her to be head of this WPA theater program, which was a small part of the WPA. The big, big part of the WPA was doing all kinds of bricks and mortar work. But there was a small part of it, which was called Federal One, and it was the arts projects, one for writing, one for visual art, one for music, and finally one for theater. And Hallie Flanagan headed up this really remarkable theater program, which accomplished so much in just 4 short years of its life.
Yeah. Now, both of them had been to Grinnell. How did their experiences there affect them?
Well, Grinnell was a very idealistic college, and it was also taught what was called the social gospel, which this was a kind of Christianity that was not anything like the Christianity of some of our current leaders. It had to do with reaching out to and including those who were poor and those who were in some way outsiders, immigrants, for instance. And so they had both been raised with this, or gone to school and learned this kind of attitude of inclusiveness. And that was a very important thing in terms of the way the WPA was run, and especially the theater program. And Hallie Flanagan was a very passionate advocate of progressive race policies and of fairness to blacks and minorities. And that really colored the theater project.
Yeah. Back to the idea of money or the importance of money, as Harry Hopkins and Hallie Flanagan are beginning to talk about this new initiative of the WPA, of the Federal One, the one for the theater,
mm-hmm.
He asked her if she could spend money.
Yeah.
Tell us
yes.
the story.
Yes. Well, they were traveling out to Iowa to actually announce this whole new federal theater initiative. They were going to announce it in Iowa. So they were traveling together on the train, and Harry Hopkins said to Hallie Flanagan, "Can you spend money?" And she was a little taken aback because Hallie Flanagan actually loved nice clothes and luxurious travel and elegant houses. And she told him that the inability to spend money is not one of my faults. But he was thinking differently about spending money. He told her it's not easy. It takes a lot of nerve to put your signature down on a piece of paper when it means that the government is going to pay out millions to the unemployed in, say, Chicago, and that means Chicago needs that money more than New York or Los Angeles. You know, and he said that you can't worry about what people are going to say because when you're handling other people's money, whatever you do is always wrong. You know, and you'll be accused of either union busting if you hold down wages, or if grinding down the poor. If you pay a decent wage, you'll be competing with private industry, and so on. And he said that you know, no matter what you do, you're going to be accused of wasting taxpayers' money. And don't forget, whatever happens, you'll be wrong. And that turned out, he knew this himself from bitter experience with the WPA budget, but that did also turn out to be one of the big themes of running the Federal Theater Project, mm-hmm. because there were always either the workers were unhappy or management was unhappy. Somebody was unhappy about the way the federal government was spending money on theater. And it was one of the delicate issues that Hallie Flanagan had to work out.
Yeah. And here in the story in your book, Furious Improvisation, it also, telling that story early provides us with a little foreshadowing, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. Because it didn't take long. It wasn't long before she had to deal with the unions, for instance, the theatrical unions, who were very incensed because she was paying less than the union standard. And then she had to deal with the theater owners, who were worried and unhappy because the Federal Theater was charging too little for tickets. So it was a very perilous proposition, yeah. to deal with all these different economic forces.
A really tough job.
Yeah.
And also for Hopkins,
big
job. You open chapter 2, Harry, with a quote from a journalist, and that provided you with the inspiration for the title, Furious Improvisation. Talk with us about that just for a moment.
Yes. This phrase, Furious Improvisation, was applied to Harry Hopkins, who really, because he had all this money to spend and had to spend it quickly because the situation was so desperate, turned out to be a wonderful improviser. This journalist said of Harry Hopkins that he was playing by ear on a giant organ with all the stops pulled out. It is the record of his entire career in Washington, improvisation at the center of a tornado. And that was true, and that's why Harry Hopkins was so effective, because he was able to improvise well. He wasn't particularly good at theater, but he respected the arts, and said right from the beginning that artists have to eat too, and that art adds to the wealth of the nation. So that's why he, with the support of Eleanor Roosevelt, insisted on funding the Federal Theater Project and the other arts projects.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Susan Quinn, author most recently of Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us this afternoon with a question or comment for our guest, give us a call. Join the conversation, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, I'm interested in your guest's comments about the WPA, and does she have anything there on the CCC camps, civilian conservation construction mm-hmm. camps?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I do write about the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. And this was another of the alphabet soup programs of the Roosevelt administration of the New Deal. And the Civilian Conservation Corps went out into the woods and built roads and built lodges and planted trees and dealt with forest fires and actually were very active in the flood in the Midwest in the mid-30s. So they did tremendous work. I'm wondering if our caller might have been in the CCC.
No, but my uncle was. I'm a little too young for that.
Yeah. Well, of course, there are not a whole lot of the CCCers left, but they were as young as 14, 15, 16. They were often very young, and many of them came to these jobs in the CCC having not had enough to eat. The average weight gain in the first 6 months in the CCC was 8 pounds.
One thing I would like to point out, if you want to know how CCC camps came to be, and subsequent WPA, TCM had a movie some time back called Gabriel Over the White House. And it was starring John Huston as a Roosevelt type, and Franco Tone as the his administrative assistant.
Probably and, Harry Hopkins.
The CCC.
That's interesting. I don't know about that film.
Because of the Million Man March on Washington after the Great Depression, and it was Roosevelt's efforts to try and put these people to work.
Yep.
Jobs they had, it vanished, and they were there at, in the area around the White House. So he ordered the Army to set up camps and pay, or rather feed, all these guys.
Yeah.
And as I say, the name of the movie is Gabriel Over the White House.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the veterans of World War One who claimed benefits and set up a camp around Washington. And that was another group of young men, but some of them may have been in the CCC. One thing about the CCC, the reason that it's in my book is because the Federal Theater Project tried to really serve all kinds of groups, and one of the groups they served were the CCC boys, as they were called, and they put together a murder mystery called the CCC Murder Mystery. And they went out to the camps with this, and in these CCC camps, they would come ahead and they would get some information about some of the boys in the camp, and they would insert those names into the script. And then they enlisted some of the boys in the camp to be on this jury for this trial in this play. And so it was kind of participatory theater with these young men, and they absolutely loved it. I have a couple of photographs of them reacting to this whole event. So this is an example of the Federal Theater reaching out in unusual ways to all kinds of different groups.
And would these young men and boys have experienced anything like this?
Nothing at all. Yeah. Nothing. They probably had seen movies because that was the new exciting thing, but probably no live theater. And if they'd seen live theater, they'd seen, you know, variety shows perhaps or vaudeville, but nothing like this. So it was a whole new event for them, and it was made possible because of this Federal Theater Project.
Yeah. Who else besides the CCC guys were in the audiences for the Federal Theater Project productions?
They did a lot of children's shows. They did shows in the parks, particularly in the cities. They had a truck which opened up and became a stage that they drove around to various parks in New York City and in other cities. I actually met an older man who told me that he had seen his first Shakespeare in a park, a Federal Theater production of a Shakespeare play in a park in New York. And so really hundreds of thousands of people saw theater for the first time. Tickets were cheap or free, and so available to lots of people. They also did a lot of children's theater. They did marionette shows. And some wonderful children's productions of Pinocchio and Hansel and Gretel, for instance. So that was another audience for the Federal Theater Project.
Yeah. You mentioned Shakespeare. Tell us about the Macbeth production that you write about in the book.
This was an amazing event. Just in general, the Federal Theater had quite a few African Americans involved in what were called Negro units around the country, and one of them was in Harlem. And Orson Welles got the job of producing a Shakespeare play with the Harlem unit and came up with the idea of doing Macbeth, an all-black Macbeth. This in itself was a new idea, to do an all-black Shakespeare. It probably had not ever been done in this country. So he produced this all-black Macbeth in Harlem, and he moved it from Scotland,
the usual setting, to Haiti, and it became called Voodoo Macbeth. And Macbeth was kind of a stand-in for Toussaint Louverture, who was a Haitian dictator. And the whole thing was a huge success in Harlem. It was really kind of a sensation, and moved then down to Broadway, where it was also successful, then toured the whole country. So Voodoo Macbeth was one of the highlights of the Federal Theater Project.
I imagine that was electrifying, that production.
Yes. Yeah. I have seen some film and of the final scenes, and it is truly electrifying.
Let's take another call now, a listener in Urbana. On line one, hi.
Hi. This question may be almost too obvious, but I'd like to ask anyway. Wouldn't this be a good model now for creating a power grid using renewable energy?
Well, the WPA, you mean, in general?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. You know, I don't know enough to answer that question very well. I can tell you sort of a related thing, which is that the Federal Theater Project was very interested in a lot of pressing issues of the time. And if it were around today, I'm sure it would be dealing with the whole issue of renewable energy and global warming.
Mm-hmm.
One of the plays they did was a play called Power, and it was what they called a living newspaper. So it was based entirely on carefully documented history and background, and it addressed the whole issue of public versus private ownership of power, of electricity. So they were addressing what was then the pressing issue, which was could the government actually run electric power plants like the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which provided electricity really for the first time to people in rural areas all over the South. So that was the issue then. If they were around now, I think they would be doing something like Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is actually unlike the living newspaper in terms of the model.
Plus, actually, the nuts and bolts of actually building the wind turbines and the solar generators and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you. I'll hang up.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited for our guest, Susan Quinn, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How did the critics respond to the productions of the Federal Theater Project?
For the most part, very positively. Brooks Atkinson of the New York Times, who is really kind of one of the great critics of all time, was a big fan of the Federal Theater. He said the Federal Theater was the best thing that ever happened to American theater. He didn't always like everything they did. They did one show for children called Revolt of the Beavers, which was sort of doctrinaire. It was about the bad capitalists running the show and the good workers who were rising up against them. And it was a children's show, but and all the characters were beavers, so it was sort of amusing, but he found it very sort of preachy, left-wing preachy, in a way that was not good for the Federal Theater Project. But on the whole, he found, for instance, the Voodoo Macbeth we talked about, he said he couldn't sleep that night. He was so excited. Mm. And he and many others rose up to defend the Federal Theater Project when it was attacked in Congress.
Also, another critic by the name of Robert Benchley wrote for The New Yorker, writing about Murder in the Cathedral. I thought this was marvelous. He said, a production of which any commercial manager would be proud, although probably no commercial manager would undertake it.
That's right.
So this was daring stuff, and it was risky if
yes.
had it been a commercial thing. So they were doing something, these actors and playwrights and others
yes.
were doing something that was out there a little bit.
Yes, and because their goal was not to make money. They didn't have to make a profit. What they had to do was employ people. The goal was to employ as many theater people as possible and take them off the relief rolls into meaningful work. That was the idea. And at its height, the Federal Theater employed 12,000 people. So the result of that was that it changed the kind of orientation, and it changed what was possible for them to do. For instance, the play you mentioned, Murder in the Cathedral, that was a play in verse about a medieval ecclesiastical controversy. You know, just not a commercial thing at all. But they were able to do it on Broadway, and it was very well received, and it had really good audiences. It did well. So because they weren't having to worry about the bottom line in the same way as a commercial theater, they were able to take risks and do unusual things that the commercial theater couldn't.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Quinn, our guest this afternoon. Let's take another call. A listener in Flat Rock, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
You were talking about the CC Cam. My dad was in it. And he was from Jasper County, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up in Willow Hill. And his family grew their own produce and had everything. And he did it. There was a depression going on until he went to the state of Washington.
Hmm.
And he said that there was all people that had nothing. And he realized it when he went to CC camp.
Yeah. Did he, was it a good experience for him?
He said it was. He had very fond memories of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Many of the CCCers remember it very fondly, and often because they were given $30 a week, and $25 of that went home to their families, and very often that was all the families had, and so they felt they were doing something really important, and really saving their families.
He had a good family life at home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said it was quite an experience. He was physically able to go to.
You know what? I don't know, for some reason
or
other.
I'm having trouble hearing.
Yeah, that we're having some dropouts there with our listener from Flat Rock. But I want to thank her for sharing the story about her father. I would imagine that, if I heard correctly, he went from rural Illinois out to the state of Washington. That must have been quite an experience.
Often they were sent far from home, and some of the CCCers, many of them, would come from, you know, the cities, and suddenly they were out in the woods. So they had to rely on their country brothers to help them learn how to, you know, handle an axe and a saw, et cetera.
Well,
but there were a lot of reminiscences of them that saying how important it was and how meaningful.
Yeah. Speaking of being on the road, mm-hmm. were the actors and playwrights and whatnot, did they go out on the road? Were Federal Theater projects something that you could find across the country?
Yes, they did go out on the road, and they played in small towns, and there was theater going on all over. One of the remarkable productions they did was called It Can't Happen Here, and it was a play about the fascism coming to America. They imagined fascism coming to America. It was by Sinclair Lewis, based on his novel. And the Federal Theater produced that in 23 different theaters all across the country. It was done in Spanish in Miami. It was done on the West Coast, an all-black company. It was done by a Yiddish company in New York. And a huge variety of versions of It Can't Happen Here all opened on the same night, which was sort of a tour de force, which demonstrated how widespread the Federal Theater was at the time.
Mm. Was that play controversial?
Yes, it was. It seemed a lot more relevant then than it might at the moment, because of course Hitler was rising in Europe and Mussolini also in Italy, so there was fascism on the rise in Europe, and It Can't Happen Here, which was about the possibility of a coming to America, didn't seem so far-fetched at the time, because there were these demagogues on the right who were preaching hatred. And then, of course, some people thought FDR was becoming a dictator. He was so enormously popular that there were many who thought that he was going too far. And in fact, FDR did some things, including his attempt to pack the Supreme Court in his second term, which suggested that he was overstepping the bounds of his power, or doing more than was allowed within the presidential powers. So, in some ways, it was a very timely play and quite popular.
Yeah, and with the election, the midterm election of 1938, some of the foes of Franklin Roosevelt were elected.
Yes.
And this here we see the fortunes of the Federal Theater Project changing.
That's right. Roosevelt, as I say, had made some bad mistakes, his attempt to pack the Supreme Court being one of them. Also, he attempted to pick off some of the Southern senators who he felt were opposed to the New Deal, and that backfired. So in 1938, there was a big conservative gain in the Congress and a real backlash against the New Deal and the New Deal programs. And Harry Hopkins was having a very hard time convincing the Congress to keep funding WPA in general. And the Federal Theater Project had been very noisy and visible, unsuccessful. So it became a natural target for the right wing. And things went downhill from there for the Federal Theater Project.
How did they make their case against the Federal Theater Project?
Well, it was really in the beginning. What started it all was a Texas congressman named Martin Dies, who founded the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1939. And his job, as he saw it, was to weed out un-Americanism. And within a few days of founding the committee, he went after the Federal Theater Project. And his argument was that the Federal Theater Project was controlled by communists. So this is really the very first time that those kind of tactics, that kind of red baiting, had occurred in the Congress. And he kind of established a pattern which continued for years afterwards. He found some unreliable witnesses or disgruntled people with very incomplete knowledge of the Federal Theater Project, and he got them to testify. And the focus, although he did attempt to prove that the Federal Theater Project was communist, the focus of a lot of the testimony was really much more about the progressive race policies of the Federal Theater Project. Interracial dating, for instance, was a subject that came up a lot in the testimony, and also the kinds of controversial plays that were done, some of which dealt with issues of race. Of course, it is important to say that the Federal Theater Project did have communists among some of its leaders, particularly in the cities, but it's also important to point out that in the 1930s, communism looked very different than it looked later, and that a lot of intellectuals were attracted to communism as an alternative to fascism and an alternative to capitalism, which seemed to be on the ropes. Mm. So his approach was to find these unreliable witnesses who gave really sort of very unfair testimony. And then after the 1938 midterm elections, he called in Hallie Flanagan, who finally got a chance to defend the Federal Theater Project, and who did a really heroic job of it, both before Martin Dies and HUAC, and then later before other congressional committees. And she got a whole lot of people, including critics and all kinds of famous actors, to come and testify in the defense of the Federal Theater Project.
Yeah. The tactics, though, were pretty rough on the part of the House Un-American Activities Committee. They were, well, I guess that it's sort of an age-old story here, but they really tried to discredit these folks.
Yes. And, you know, their way of doing it was to find some obscure piece of writing, you know, and quote it verbatim.
Take it out of context.
And take it out of context and make the person look bad. To ask a lot of questions about, are you a member of the Communist Party, and who among your federal theater members is a member of the Communist Party, and so on, to keep asking that question over and over and over again, to which Hallie Flanagan said that she didn't know who was, because the policy of the government then, and I think since, is that people's affiliations outside of the workplace are not are private and are not not relevant, and that, you know, you can't ask about them, and they shouldn't be a basis for hiring or firing. So anyway, she kept being backed into a corner by them.
And also, she was made to explain her trip to Russia as a young woman who was studying theater. She had gone to Europe and studied theater in a number of countries, including including Russia.
Yes. And she was, like everyone else in the 20s, she was very excited about the Russian theater because they were doing really innovative things. People like Meyerhold, who were doing really new, innovative work, were, everyone in New York was going to Russia and observing their theater and learning from it. So, you know, it wasn't proof of anything. But this was used by Dyes and others to suggest that she was un-American and that she wanted to bring Russian theater to America, which was completely not true. What she said at one point, somebody said, "Well, would you produce a communist play?" To which she replied, "I'd produce a Republican play if it were good enough." And what she cared about really was producing good theater.
Yeah.
I think that was the bottom line for her.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that she said when it all came down was that a couple of reasons stand out in my reading of her take on this is that, as you mentioned, the fear of racial equity and providing thought-provoking theater to the masses, to Americans.
That's right. And what she said in her, after the Federal Theater ended, when Congress cut off funds, she wrote an editorial in the New York Times, and she said that that Congress was afraid of the project, but not for the reasons that they claimed, that they were afraid because it was educating people to know more about government and policies and such vital issues of the day as housing, power, agriculture, and labor. They were afraid, and rightly so, of thinking people. And I think that is true. And I think also that it's hard for us to realize now how powerful and how racist the Southern congressmen were. Around the time that all this was happening, there was a debate going on about an anti-lynching law, whether Congress should pass a law against lynching. And the Southern congressman filibustered against that, and the Congress didn't pass that law until much later. So that's the context in which the Federal Theater was operating. And the Federal Theater insisted on integrated audiences. They had a number of very successful and visible Negro units around the country, like the Voodoo Macbeth group, and some integrated casts, which was quite new and radical at the time. So all of those things were threatening to the status quo, and particularly to the Southern segregationist powers that had a lot of control of Congress.
Mm. Did the congressmen who were responsible for the demise of the Federal Theater Project, did they ever respond to what she had written for the New York Times in the opinion piece?
She kept attempting over and over again to get them to come and see something. For instance, there was a wonderful production of Pinocchio going on right around the time of the HUAC hearings. And she kept trying to get the congressman to come and see this children's production, which was very, very popular. It was sold out every night on Broadway. But none of them came, and certainly none of them responded to her to her Times attack opinions or much of anything else about what she had to say.
Would bringing some of these productions back to the stage, would that be possible today, and or reworking them somehow? But remembering this part of the history of the American theater.
Yes. I think there are some plays which I read and I think would be wonderful. There was a play called Great White Fog, for instance, which was produced in Chicago, which I thought was what I read. I thought was a marvelous play. Langston Hughes thought it was one of the very best plays of the century, and it was done by the Federal Theater. I think that the living newspaper format would be interesting. To apply, you know, you had a caller earlier who talked about the whole issue of the environment and so on, and I can see that format working to do an evening like a living newspaper evening, certainly.
Hmm. There we have to leave it where we used up the time and went so quickly. Susan Quinn, Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure.
Susan Quinn is the author of four books, including a biography of Marie Curie and the book Human Trials, which is the story of the development and testing of new drugs. Her latest book, Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times, is published by Walker and Company. And there's more about the book and its author, Susan Quinn, online at www.furiousimprovisation.com. And that interview with Susan Quinn was conducted on July 28th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine. Jason Croft is our technical director. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, 62 degrees in Urbana. We're going to find out now what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago at the Boards of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Taking a look at the numbers as they settled in Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon. Futures were sharply lower in both the corn and the beans. Part and parcel of that was the grain stocks report this morning. The quarterly grain stocks report showing more corn on hand at the end of the year than some had expected. That's probably a slow up in the export market. We talked about that on Commodity Week over the weekend. And soybeans at $205 million, up sharply. $145 was the expectation, about $150 million. But $205 is what the USDA says is on hand now in the bins. And that pushed the marketplace there down another 49 cents than the nearby November beans. Wheat futures were higher today. December contract up 12 cents, a 689.5 top. We'll start here, 662.5 the bottom. And December wheat in Chicago settled $6.80. The soft red up 12 today. March futures up 12.25, 710 the high, the low at 684.25. And a settlement price at 701.25, 12.25 higher for the March wheat. May futures 722, the high, the low at $7. Settlement price at 716.25, up 12.75. In July 737, the high, the low at 712.75. Settlement price at 729, up 13 cents in the soft red winter wheat pit. Spring wheat futures in the Minneapolis Grain Exchange unchanged today. 746.75 the settlement price. And the hard red settled the December contract at 712 in Kansas City, met the Board of Trade, up 7 cents. At the Board of Trade in Chicago, corn futures were 25.5 lower today. 524.75 was the top for the December, the harvest month bottom at 485.5, and a settlement price below $5. $4.87.5, 25.5 cents lower for December corn futures. March contract 542.75, the high, the low at 504.75, settlement price at 506.5, down 24.5. In the May futures, 546.75 high, low at 517.75, settlement price at 518.5, down 24 cents. July contract 563.75, the high, the low at $5.28. Settled at 529.5, down 23 cents. In September, 556.5, the high, the low at $5.37. Settlement price at 534.5, down 22 on the day. Next year's December contract at 570, top the bottom at 39.5. December corn for 2009 settled at $5.41.25, down 17.5 cents. December oat futures 321, the high, the low at 315.25, settlement price at 316, 2 cents lower on the day. November soybeans today $10.96, the high, the low at 1039. Settlement price up off that low at $10.45, still a loss of 49 cents on the day for the November soybeans. January futures, $11.12¾, the high, the low at $10.56½, a settlement price at $10.62¼, down 48 and a quarter. And the March, $11.26, the high, the low at $10.71¼. Settled at $10.77½, down 46¾. May futures in the bean pit, $11.37, the high, the low at $10.85. Settlement price at $10.89¾, down 47¼. And next year's July settled at $10.99, down 48¼. The November 09 contract, an $11.10 top, bottom at $10.69. Settlement price at $10.74 a bushel, finished 35½ cents lower for the November 2009 soybean contract. October bean meal futures today, $2.94.30, the high, the low at $2.78. Settlement price at $2.79.40, down 16.30. And December bean meal, $2.85, down $16.40. December bean oil futures, $44.71 the high, the low at $43.39. Settlement price at $44 even, 70 cents lower. December contract, $45.35 the high, the low at $43.85. Settlement price for the December soybean oil at $44.48, down 95 cents on the afternoon. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time, just about 10 minutes away now, when we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now let's take a look at what happened today in Chicago at the Merck. Cattle prices higher today. October live cattle, $99.80 the high, the low $98.65, the settlement $98.90, that up $85. December $101.45 the high, $100.10 the low, $100.37½ the settlement, that up $50. February $101.45 the high, $100.50 the low, settling at $100.72½, that up $62½. April live cattle, $101.40 the high, $100.57½ the low, the settlement $100.85, that up $57½. October feeder cattle, $104.90 the high, $103.55 the low, $104 even the settlement, that up $120. November, $104.60 the high, $103.15 the low, $103.72½ the settlement, that up $115. January, $104.40 the high, $103.60 the low, $103.65 the settlement, that up $85. March, $104.65 the high, $103.20 the settlement, $104.10 that ending the day up $130. The October lean contract, the October lean hogs contract today finished up 25. Make that 2½. Excuse me. October lean hogs, $69.60 the high, $68.20 the low, $68.57½ the settlement, that up $2½. December lean hog, $65.80 the high, $64 even the low, $64.20 the settlement, that down $85. February, $71.70 the high, $70.30 the low, $70.65 the settlement, that down $55. And April lean hogs, $76.95 the high, $75.35 the low, the settlement, $75.65, that down $120. And February pork bellies finished down $3 today, $95.90 the high, the low, and the settlement, $93.75. Again, that down $3. The Dow currently up 381 points at 10,746. The NASDAQ up 87 at 2071. The S&P 500 up 50 at 1156. It's coming up on 2 o'clock Central Time. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. Let's take a look at Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. This afternoon, in northern and eastern Indiana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers. In southern Illinois, mostly sunny. Elsewhere, a mix of clouds and sun, breezy and cool, highs ranging from 60 in the north to 72 in the far south. Tonight in northern and eastern Indiana,